Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Keep those emails and positive energy and love flowing that way to Tim Dennis. He said he appreciates it and thanks all of you for your kind messages and show of support and love as he battles bronchitis. He's coming out the other side of this and he should be fine within the next few days and back to his old self by Monday for our Supernatural News Parashare episode. Today we're going to take a look. There's a book coming out in March, and I found the title of it fascinating. A Culture, The Unseen Forces That Drive Culture Forward. And joining us from Sweden, we have the author with us right now, Carl Abramson, and he is spending some time with us this evening. I know you're about 7 hours ahead of us, I think. Is that right?
That's right. No, it depends on where you are. I'm sort of 6 hours ahead of New York, Eastern Standard Time.
Yep, and I'm 1 hour behind New York. So, yeah, we're right in that 7 hour swing here.
Yep.
This is fascinating. And let me, just so I can give our listeners a little bit of background, you're a writer, publisher, and how do I say this? Magico-anthropologist?
That's correct.
What is a magico-anthropologist?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Of course, you know, they're especially now, the world of academia is no longer, you know, so tight and rigid. And these areas which, you know, existed under the umbrella of anthropology, for instance, usually tied in with sociology, usually tied in with the history of religions, these, you know, more well-known subjects. But interestingly enough, as the esoteric sphere, what you usually call like Western esotericism and other kinds of esotericism, has sort of snuck into the world of academia, and there are even chairs and, you know, professors and loads of books on academic presses about magic and magical stuff, which I think is great. I originally thought of the term when I was young and considerably more, you know, misanthropic in a way.
Okay.
So I actually started something called the Institute for Comparative Misanthropology. I thought that was, you know, a fun thing and a play on words and stuff like that. But as I progressed and probably got a little bit more mature, I realized that I was so interested in all of these arcane subjects, and also, you know, anthropology and psychology and how people relate to magic in different cultures and in history. So basically I found that, you know, hey, misanthropology, that's cool when you're young, but really where I'm at, it's magical anthropology. And, you know, this was probably like mid-90s. And since then, I think that the world has caught up in a way. So I would say that there is actually something called magical anthropology right now, even in the academic world. It's the study of magic, basically, how human beings and entire cultures relate to the fascinating topic of magic.
And since the mid-80s, you've been very active in the magical community, integrating a culture as kind of a way of life and lecturing about your findings, your speculations.
Mm-hmm.
This is fascinating. What drew you to this study and fascination with magic to begin with?
Mm-hmm. I think that in the very, very sort of early beginnings, like when you're a teenager, which in my case was, you know, exactly that, you know, mid-80s, basically. Of course, you're like a sponge. You take in all these things, you know, like trash culture and B-movies, and I was very much in, you know, enamored with American pop culture and B-movies, and also the things, you know, occultism is always there. It's like a little shadow that comes, pops out when you're a teenager, and of course, I delved into that, too. And there were certain imprints that made a strong mark, basically. I didn't start, you know, studying Crowley with the Book of the Law and all those, you know, technical books on magic. I actually started with his autobiography, or as he called it himself, his autohagiography, the biography of a saint. That was fun because his life was so wild and crazy and magical at the same time. And also, as I said, I was very much into B-movies, and one of my favorite icons, actresses, was Jane Mansfield. And of course, she had a fling at some point with Anton LaVey. And Anton LaVey and his Church of Satan was just like, whoa, this is so cool, I can't believe it. So basically, what happened then was that I was like a hungry sponge, I took in all of this information, and then gradually began studying. But at the same time, things happened in my life that basically changed it forever. And that's that I was always an outreaching person. I was a networking person. And we have to keep in mind, of course, this was pre-internet times. So I was subscribing to information from the Temple of Psychic Youth in the UK, for instance. And then I interviewed Genesis Peorage for my music fanzine at the time, so it wasn't really an occult angle, but I became so fascinated by what they were doing, this sort of grassroots occult movement. I got involved and I started producing stuff, you know, and everything had to do with some aspect of occultism, even the trashy rock and roll records that I put out. And one of those records was a song about Anton LaVey and Jane Mansfield and their little romance. And Genesis said that, you know, hey, you should send that to Anton LaVey. And I said, sure, you know, so I did. And then I got this letter back saying that, you know, if you're ever in San Francisco, please come by. And I did. And I was just at that time like 22, 23 years old. And that also changed my life. And on the same trip, I was welcomed by Kenneth Anger in Los Angeles. And this was in 1989. So that was like the most mind-blowing trip I've ever been on, basically. And it changed my life. And I felt so welcomed by these people that I had for a short period of time idealized, both from like a star perspective, celebrity's perspective, but also from the magical point of view. I felt a strong sense of resonance in terms of the magic that these people were doing.
Can I stop you right there? When we refer to magic, I mean, a lot of the world has different aspects or different views on what the word magic means. To some of us, it's illusion and fun. It's sleight of hand and smoke and mirrors. Yeah. To others, it's nothing but alchemy and medicine. Magic was considered medicine for a long time, or medicine was considered magic. But then there's this kind of strange gray area where things outside of our normal realm of understanding and consciousness lie. Mm-hmm. And that's also in this kind of realm of magic. Which angles and aspects of these terms are you most focused on?
I would say I'm most focused on what I prefer to call the colorful gray area, which is like a hefty mix of there's psychology there, there's occultism there, meaning sort of traditional approaches to manipulating one's life. So, you know, there are these, could be material goals, could also be immaterial goals, but this belief that by doing certain things that has repercussions that are hopefully beneficial to your own life and what you want to achieve in life. When I started out, I took everything, you know, at face value. I saw it for what it was. It had usually strong historical ties, like the Crowley environment has strong historical ties to Crowley and the Golden Dawn and the OTO and that kind of carrying on a tradition in a kind of a sort of Freemasonic structure, whereas the Church of Satan had a more controversial and provocative libertarian, in a way, view, and the Temple of Psychic Youth was more anarchic, experimental. So all of these things basically had to do with existential issues. You know, I'm interested in these things. Can they affect my life in a positive way? And I approached it with a very, you know, open-minded, empirical mind frame, and I found that it did. So doing rituals, meditations, holistic thinking, all of these things sort of became a cluster that I gradually integrated more and more and more in my own way of life. And that's basically how I would say that what magic means to me.
And when you talk to people like Anton LaVey, I mean, a lot of people say this man was nothing more than just a forward thinker, progressive, and using a provocative way to garner attention by the Church of Satan and the very demonic-y look and attitude that he took on a lot of this. Yeah. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I met him at a point in his life when he was reclusive. He didn't see very many people. Still hung out in the, you know, classic black house in San Francisco, but didn't really live there. At times they did, but they had another place also. So it wasn't that kind of, you know, showmanship. There wasn't that atmosphere of being bold, being provocative. It was more like, you know, staying home and seeing friends, playing music, watching movies and networking. And I think also in hindsight that he was looking for people to talk to about the future, you know, to carry it on, both of course, you know, carrying the Church of Satan on, but also sowing seeds in people that he found some kind of resonance with to carry on that spirit. And for me, at that time, I thought it was part, you know, cool, the word cool. It was very cool to hang out there. And I did that several times during a couple of years up until 1993. That was the last time that I met him. But it was obvious to me that there's more to this than meets the eye. Basically, saying that in the 60s when he concocted this thing and up until the mid 70s, it was very extroverted. There was a lot of, you know, rituals for show, catering to the press, stuff like that. And then later on, much later, there was this turning in like the official attitude of the Church of Satan and also in his own mind frame that, you know, we're not religious, we're not spiritual. Those words are not, usable for something. And in a way that was kind of a, not demeaning, but it was sort of like a downgrade of the concept of magic. But for me, having been there, I could say that there was a lot of magic going on there. And I mean that by, you know, non-rational ways of handling reality, sowing seeds for the future, and all of the sort of the occult strong imagery and symbols, all of that was in use. LaVey was just a very, very, as you said, forward-thinking person. He didn't have to deal with old arcane symbols and rituals. He did magic via his music, for instance, when he played music. Consciously using the concept of playing music to affect change in the outside world. So he was kind of radical.
Now, you say that. I love people that are involved in this and study. They're just so very basic regarding these kind of things. And you're like, oh, yeah, he just, you know, he used his magic his music as a magic to influence and change the world. But for those of us on the outside, how is somebody using music? And I mean, I love music personally, and I know music affects me and how it affects the people around me.
Sure.
But
yeah.
How, you know, I've never heard Anton LaVey's music. How is that changing the world around us by having this music that may not be familiar with, you know, 90% of the culture out there?
Mm-hmm. Sure. No, that's a very, very legitimate question. I think it could work. You could say that it worked basically in two ways. The first one is, of course, a very magical or sort of open-minded, holistic, philosophical concept, which is the butterfly effect. So this conversation that you and I are having now, we via the internet, it's still audible, you know, and the podcast will be audible. So according to that theory, it will be audible forever. We can hear it right now because our ears are here, but the sounds, the vibrations will just carry on forever. So in that sense, when you play music with a magical determination, that will resound, sound and resound forever. And then if you have an intention woven into that piece of music, like he often did, then, you know, according to that theory, it will just carry on. And it's the same thing you know, with Wi-Fi, you know, we know that there's the internet that's actually cables and it goes to hubs and routers and stuff like that. But I mean, I can't see the internet here. I'm looking at my router and it's blinking, but I have no idea how it works. Yet it allows for me to talk to you, who, and you're in America. That's kind of a magical concept. So it's not as far-fetched, I think, with the butterfly theory, the butterfly thing. I think that maybe someone in the future can explain that, you know, scientifically or debunking.
But the difference is, scientifically, we know that there are waves, there are measurable transference between your place and my place to make this conversation happen from Sweden to America. All right, so we know that that exists. But the idea that we put forth an intention in a song that will somehow cause a ripple effect, I think that's where a lot of people get confused on this. And I, you know what, hell, I believe music probably has more power than anything for curing, for attitude change. I've told some of the, you know, doing the show for as long as we have, being open about my own struggles with depression and anxiety, when people will reach out to me on social media and say, I'm so down, Dave, I don't know what to do. I'll tell them, what's your favorite music to listen to? Put on your favorite music, sing at the top of your lungs, and dance around for half an hour. I guarantee you're going to feel different.
And
a lot of people have done that, right? They've come back to me and they're like, holy crap, that was totally life-changing.
Yeah.
And I said, right, because you're taking yourself out of your misery and your mindset for a short time, and you're allowing something that fills you and makes you happy in, and that is life-altering. So I understand that resonance of it, but then you think, all right, but we're familiar with 80s music or country music or rap or whatever fulfills us. But how does the music of somebody who people don't hear, how does that affect? But you're saying it's kind of in the translation of, even though it's out there and it's a non-measurable, scientifically measurable activity, that it is still impacting and affecting the world in the design of magic itself.
Right, exactly. Okay, I can absolutely explain that to the best of my ability. So let's have that, you know, the butterfly effect, the ripple effect, that we can leave that aside. It's still, you know, it's a valid theory, but it is still a theory. But if we look at the concrete aspect of, for instance, Anton LaVey weaving magic spells with his music, then of course you could say by proxy there are recordings, there are the records, and people might like them. But still, that's an abstracted step away. But for me, for instance, I was there. He had this huge synthesizer park in his kitchen. It was really fun to be there, and he was such a skilled magician, really like a, you know, what's that Marx brother? Chico. He was like Chico Marx, you know, actually impersonating Chico, the way he played and toyed with his fingers. Just a skillful, you know, musician, having worked in circuses with circus music and stuff like that. And also striptease, burlesque in the 50s. So he was really a good showman. However, his playing those tunes in that kind of playful, jovial way, yet some songs were, you know, depressed and dark and stuff like that, that affected me to the extent that I integrated, you know, his concepts, his teaching in a way, to the point where you and I are talking about it today. So in that sense, he made himself maybe not completely immortal, but he certainly lived on through the experiences that I had in his kitchen. And there are several people who can vouch for the same thing, that, you know, it was great to sit there and have a drink with him and talk with him and stuff like that. But the big thing was always to be sort of dragged into the kitchen, because then you know that some music was forthcoming, and it was truly mind-blowing. So in that sense, whatever designs he had for instance, just, you know, staying on in the consciousness of people a little bit longer, I would say that magic worked.
I would agree. I mean, there's definitely something to that. And his memory, his image continues to live on, whether it's in a place of fear or a place of even misunderstanding. It still resounds, and it causes people to want to learn or educate and listen to shows like this, pick up books, read, and find out about this.
Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned another gentleman, and I'm sorry, I got off track. Was it Kenneth Anger?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I met Kenneth Anger on the same trip there in 1989 as I met Anton LaVey.
All right, I'm not as familiar with Kenneth Anger, so please enlighten.
Anger is one of he's very old now. I think he's like 90, and he was one of the most prominent experimental filmmakers from the mid 1940s and onwards. And you know, that was at the time when people are, you know, really experimenting with the film form and art film and stuff like that. And there was kind of a wave of American cinema called the New American Cinema that he was part of. But his stuff was always about occult, esoteric, magical things. And Kenneth Anger has been like an ambassador for the philosophy that Crowley put forth, which is called Thelema. So that's his glamour. And I actually, at that time, before I went over to America, I had finished a thesis at the University of Stockholm in what you call like film history about Aleister Crowley's influence in Kenneth Anger's film. So that was also like a ticket into that world, which was, of course, mind-blowing to get to meet him so soon after having worked with the stuff on a distant theoretical level. And Anger...
Now, do you think that by putting together that dissertation that you'd worked on, your paper, do you think that put into effect and an intention and butterfly effect, yes, that drew him into your life?
Yep. But then, of course, I was lucky in the sense that this is also kind of a close-knit, small community. So I know for a fact that I had set up when, you know, trying to get to meet Anger, and I did have some, you know, friends of. So that was, you know, kind of a loose thing. But I know for sure that I was going to go to San Francisco to meet LaVey because I had that invitation. And of course, they had been friends. Anger was, LaVey was part of one Kenneth Anger film from the 60s. You know, he had been very, you know, positive about the Church of Satan. So I know for a fact that LaVey and Anger spoke on the phone after I'd been up there in San Francisco. And that meant also that I had like a greeting card. I was welcomed. I had sort of an invisible, a letter of introduction in
a way. Right. You became the conduit to which these two connected.
Yeah.
Fascinating. All right, very cool. You've got this. Now, a lot of people, and maybe you can walk me through the mindset on where this kind of jumped. When people hear occult, immediately they start jumping to dark principles, dark arts and magics.
Yeah.
Is there a reason for that? Was that part of the press of it? Was that to garner attention so that it would raise eyebrows?
I think no, not consciously. I think it's a two-way, a two-edged sword. And the thing is, on the one hand, occultism or the umbrella called occultism is basically, it's a misnomer, you know. Occult in Latin means hidden. And the reason why all of this teaching and knowledge has been hidden is, that's what I mean by a two-edged sword. One side of it is that it's been keeping teachings secret. Coming in from the East, from, you know, from Africa, from Asia, from Europe proper, and just, you know, just these little groups or individuals or little covens or orders having kept some kind of flame burning over the centuries. And why have they had to keep these things hidden? Well, primarily because the philosophies that they have contained, not seldom carrying a torch of individual liberty, for instance, and, you know, being against the church. So, of course, the church in Europe, mainly the Catholic Church, they've been very opposed. I mean, the Inquisition is one thing, the witch hunts, witch burnings, all of that stuff has to do with essentially other kinds of things, but it's all been under the guise of, you know, cleaning up from the occultists. So that's one thing. But there's also been the pure propaganda, you know, saying that these people are devil worshippers, these people are this or that. But when you look closer at it, you know, either it's been like wise women who have didn't want to succumb to some kind of, you know, societal pressure, or it could have been some radical early scientists, you know, like Galileo, stuff like that. They were executed. You know, they were executed for showing how the universe really is organized, how it's structured. And these people who were these sort of eminent pre-scientists, Isaac Newton, Galileo, there's a bunch of them throughout each century, they were actively interested in occult topics, meaning this conglomerate, this cluster of alchemy and teachings, Greek esoteric teachings from antiquity that also came in via classical Egyptian times, like thousands of years ago. Still, the flame has been brought onwards. And I would say that perhaps in their own mythological sense, Freemasonry carries on with that thing, this thing where there's individual liberty and also these classical things, alchemy. Old school initiation rituals and old school arcane symbolism. I think, though, and that's always been one of my pet projects, is to talk about this from a contemporary perspective, from a cultural perspective. That's not because I don't believe that kind of old arcane magic doesn't work. I do believe that it works, but I find it more relevant to look at our own times, to see, you know, how is this relevant to us? What forms does it take?
Well, with that in mind, you'd think, all right, listen, there's been some amazing periods in our world when people have come together for a greater purpose. But in the cosmic scheme of things, nothing radically changed, right? I mean, you know, we are the world, Band-Aid, Hands Across America, all of these things where people came together with good feelings, good intention, love, purity, and whatever. You would think that those would have been true moments of magic that would have caused deep impact and deep reflective measures in a world that would have been measurable. Do you see that it did? And maybe I'm just too cynical and it passed by me. You and I grew up in the same time in the 80s, right? Mid-80s.
Yeah. I remember that so well. And I mean, there have been so many instances of do-gooders wanting to do good. And I'm sure that some of that money was put to good use. I hope so, at least. But that's the thing, you know, with good intentions doesn't mean that the result becomes like you wanted it. I mean, like when you talk about the international aid in general, like to impoverished or regions of crisis and chaos and famine or war torn places, you know, rich, wealthy countries can send, you know, billions, millions of dollars, but very little of the money actually gets to the people who really need it. And that's because there's such a heavy heavy infrastructure. And, you know, I don't know, surely some shady things going on too. But I think, and this is where I find Crowley, LaVey, but also people from other angles like Carl Jung, you know, who had the psychological, mythological angle, and many, many other people, contemporary people too, who claim that, you know, all of this is fair and fine. We can do things together. We can band up and gang up and do things that we find is good for the greater good. But nothing really changes unless we change ourselves, meaning that the impact of this philosophy and of magic in general can only be fully understood and fully integrated on the individual level. Because if we are entangled in other people, like saying, you should do this, you should do that, which is the classical approach of religion, then that will not allow the individual to be fully free. And I believe that, you know, to maximize some kind of, you know, concept like happiness, one needs to do it oneself. One needs to find out who, you know, I need to find out who I am, and then I need to do that thing that I find out. And if I don't do that, I will be super neurotic.
Now, when you talk of the names of LaVey as well and anger, was there dark aspects to the magic that they did? And is there positivity in dark magic or dark intention? Can we get something from somebody's negative focus?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And these are great questions that you're posing. I'm happy about that because usually people are so prone to, you know, consciously misunderstanding things. Of course, let's define the darkness of this kind of thing. It's easy to project that on LaVey because he called his group Church of Satan, you know, and traditionally, culturally, Satan has been like a negative force. He and the church, you know, they claim that Satan is not some kind of anthropomorphic beast. It's not having to do with any kind of evil. Evil is a very, you know, word that's very difficult to define.
Right, but it's subjective.
It's very subjective.
Right.
And that's the thing, you know. They believed, and when I say they, I specifically mean the Church of Satan and LaVey. You know, there was strong psychological insight, and LaVey was very interested in contemporary psychology too, and, you know, and this thing with, you know, catharsis and actually, you know, cherishing the ego, not trying to, you know, minimize its impact like in the Eastern religions, and carrying some kind of moral based in this loosely concocted thing called karma. You know, karma is another word for some kind of spiritual moral causality, where you do one thing and it has this thing, but it's imbued with morals. And I think that the darker groups or darker people basically said that what's good for me is good, but that doesn't imply that everything I do will be bad for other people. That's like, you know, the evangelical Christian approach, which is so dualist. You know, if you don't ascribe to our God and our interpretation of it, then you are evil. It's a simplification. But if you look to the human psyche and how that works and how multifaceted it is, you know, maybe cursing someone that bugs you, and I'm sure a lot of kids in schoolyards, you know, can feel a relief if they make a little proxy, like a little voodoo doll, and stick that with pins, and the doll symbolizes their bully, their schoolyard bully. And that was the idea that LaVey brought up, that all of these things can be symbolic, but to work with symbols and this kind of active imagination, that was also advocated by someone like Carl Jung, who is not, doesn't have that, you know, dark thing projected on him. He was more of a skilled, enlightened psychologist. But there is this thing, you know, dealing with active imagination, being honest about what one feels about certain people. And if certain people are, like LaVey, you know, coined this beautiful term, psychic vampires, one has to get rid of them. Otherwise, one will be vampirized, and who wants to be that? That doesn't mean that one has to take any criminal steps or anything. You can clean that out in yourself by doing a ritual for it. Then whether that has any effect, it's kind of secondary. The main thing is that your own relationship to the problematic issue at hand or the person is resolved.
Isn't that interesting that whole aspect of what and who Anton LaVey is or was?
Mm-hmm.
Is predicated on the look and the way he did it. And so many people don't bother to pick up and read the story to get the interest and the information behind what the actual principles were that he was utilizing. Because it sounds like it really sounds, I mean, once you get past the creepy look and the pointy goatee, right? What you've got here is a new Carl Jung, or you've got a philosopher who's doing nothing but finding a unique way to teach a belief system.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I think that the reason why LaVey used, you know, the word Satan, he had been interested in arcane stuff, and he was interested in psychology before he started doing, you know, these magical meetings and little group meetings in San Francisco and stuff like that. But when it came to organizing this thing and integrating the word Satan, and of course, you know, that was a shocker. That was a moral shocker, a religious shocker. He got a lot of attention, and that, you know, that was good because that was he was after. He also, to an extent, used the what we call the S word, Satan, as a kind of bullshit detector in a way, because why waste time on someone who freaks out when they hear the word Satan? That means that they will not be susceptible to understanding these concepts that could be beneficial for them. On the other hand, if someone said, Satan, I don't believe in any anthropomorphic Satan, then LaVey would say, neither do I. It's a symbol. It's a symbol for, you know, man's feral nature, the stripped nature of man that's basically a beast of prey, like any other animals, beasts of prey. We are more civilized in a way, more refined, but on another level, we are absolutely less so. Because we not only sort of can destroy for other people, we also destroy our own habitats and our own lives, basically, if we are not enlightened to the point where we can realize this is not what I want to do in my life. I need to change this. And then what kind of symbols you use, that's in a way, it's secondary. You can use whatever you want. And for instance, let's stick with this LaVey Jung comparison. There are two S words in both. You know, LaVey called it Satan. Jung called it the shadow. You know, the shadow principle in Jung's thought is very interesting because he claimed, as did Freud in a different way, that if the stuff that you repress, it will come forth, it will come up and it will haunt you. Because that's how the human psyche works, how it's structured. You can't keep pent-up aggression down. You can't keep pent-up frustration down. It will come up. So it's better to integrate it, be aware of it, get to know it, get to know yourself.
We've got to discuss so much more. I want to get into this, and especially the idea of art and magic.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I've got some points that I'd like to bring up and get your feedback on. Stay tuned. We've got a lot more to discuss with our guest when we return to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
A culture, the unseen forces that drive culture forward. Our guest today, all the way from Sweden, Carl Abramson. The book will be out in March. We have a link up for the book right now. If you go to darknessradio.com, click on our Killer Deals tab, you'll find this book and all the other great books, but you can pre-order it, get it available right now, either for paperback or Kindle. The links are up on our site. Go to darknessradio.com, click on that. And please do me a favor, not only with this book, but all the authors. If you've purchased any of the books from our authors, please make sure you go review them on Amazon, because that goes a long way for more exposure so other people can find these fantastic authors and these great books. So if you can review them and post those reviews, it costs you nothing to give them a 5-star review and write something nice. So just go do that. It's a good thing to do, and it continues to perpetuate the paranormal field, because if the authors and the publishers and Amazon keep seeing a want and desire for these books and that people are taking the time to review them, they will continue to request them. They will continue to bring out new literature on this all of the time. So keep that in mind. Carl, I wanted to talk about this too, because it's interesting as you talk about kind of the intention set in LaVey's music, and you look at art, and you look at art in all forms. There is music that can move you to laugh, dance, sing, cry. There is artwork that you can go to a museum that you see that for no unseen reason, you begin to feel emotions or a change in who you are. Yeah. Now, do you believe that, I mean, and I don't want to get into too much of the metaphysical woo-woo aspect that makes people roll their eyes, but do you think that in those cases that there is something crafted into these pieces that go beyond just me chiseling away at a piece of marble and, you know, creating a naked man? There's something inside of what I've created. There's something alive that I've imparted onto these creations, music, art, movie, whatever it might be.
Yeah, no, I absolutely think that. And I think it could also be looked at in many ways. But if we stick with two main things, you know, it could be done, you know, by the artist consciously or unconsciously. You know, the artist who maybe thinks that he or she is great, and he or she may be great also, and just, as you say, chiseling away or painting away or writing music or doing whatever it is that this artist is doing. You know, if they are conscious about it, about their own greatness, that's fine. You know, because as long as there is desire, a strong desire to convey something to the person who is the recipient of this, and there's like an emotional charge, and if the artist is good enough, you know, that will happen. But it doesn't require that the artist is conscious of the process. There could, you know, equally well be someone who is, you know, just has this strong yearning to desire this thing in this way, and can't really know, or perhaps can't even be bothered with, you know, being interested in how people react. But at the same time, people will react. And, you know, we talked about music before. I mean, that's such an amazingly powerful expression that, you know, because that doesn't go first through the rational mind. It doesn't go through the intellect, because when you see something you know, ocularly with your eyes, like a painting in a museum or a sculpture. It's not really tactile. You see it. You see it. And then we are so used to seeing our eyes. That's the most, you know, I guess, important way of interpreting and taking in sensual information. But it's filtered through the rational mind and through the intellect. So it's harder.
And boy, if you want to talk about, if I can mention real quickly, you want to talk about real magic. Music can transport you.
Oh yeah.
It can transport you through time. You can feel, I mean, it's uncanny to me, Carl, how there are times I'll hear a song and I can almost smell the cotton candy at the carnival.
Yeah.
That night I was holding hands with my girl and we walked through and you could hear the sounds and the music playing and it transports part of who you are. And I wonder, you mentioned that, right, some artists have it, some do not. And you look at, like, street artists who are knocking out 200 paintings a day. You'll go, oh, that's neat looking, and you may pick it up. But it's totally different than what you'll see from the Van Goghs or you'll see from Rembrandts, because there's something more. There's more a part of those paintings. There's more a part of that art that they poured into it and may not have even been consciously aware of what they were doing. Wasn't it, I think it's Jimmy Page ended up buying a castle that was owned by, was it Crowley, right?
Yeah. It wasn't a castle. It was more like a tiny estate.
In Minnesota, it's considered a castle.
okay, then it was a castle. It was by Loch Ness in Scotland.
He's gone on record as a few times saying that there was something about that location and music would pour forth from him, and he was inspired by that. And you wonder, is that the portal? Is that a tap to the magic because you feel a connection to either who lived there before you, the area, the land, the magic of the properties? What was it that draws this out of people?
Yeah, I would say in this case, it's a mix. It's a kind of a cluster of inspiration. Of course, you know, it's a highly romantic thing to buy the place where your idol lived and wrote so many books on magic. And if you're interested in that yourself, it's like, kind of like, you know, like becomes like a talismanic proxy in a way. You get moved and affected in a positive, inspiring way by, for instance, touching something that has belonged to someone that you like. And, you know, hence the magic of the autograph. Why the hell do people, you know, stand in line for a long time to get something autographed? You mean, the stuff is like a comic book or a book. It's good in itself, you know, but people care about these things. It's a magical way of comporting yourself. You know, hey, you know, I love Harry Potter, but hey, J.K. Rowling, she's signing the books tomorrow at this bookstore. Yeah, I'll stand in line for 4 hours. And I wonder, why is that? And I can't see any other reason. Is that it brings the thing, the inanimate thing, alive. And for you know, in terms of Jimmy Page and that kind of experience, he had the money to buy that place, and it was like a romantic overdrive in his romantic yearning for Crowley as a kind of a guru that he never had, because Crowley died in 1947. But, you know, Crowley's teachings affected Jimmy Page, and he wanted to collect his stuff, and he has, you know, bought paintings, manuscripts, rare books, you know. And why do people do that? They want to retain the maximum level of inspiration by magical proxy. It's a fascinating phenomenon.
Right. We know in the world of the paranormal, there's psychometry, which is, you know, you're holding a ring or you're holding a piece of property or a picture of somebody, and you're pulling from it the energy that was theirs. So that there is something to that. Because like you, I'm often confused. Why? And listen, trust me. A year ago, I flew out to California on a whim to stand in line overnight over 24 hours to meet Bruce Springsteen, get his autograph, take a picture with him, and then I was back on a plane within 24 hours. Boom. Yeah. All done and said. And you sit there and you go, why? What did this? But you know what? I've got something that is connected to the person that has had an impact in my life. And I had a chance to vocalize something to him and get a response. So there is that. That in itself is a kind of magic as well, because then that connection has been made and it's funny. I laughed about this, and I was going through it and talking about magic and the set of intention. You know, I had so many people rooting for me to make that trip and go see Springsteen and meet him, and it was great. But this last year on Facebook, of all things, right? Here's a great place. This is your spell book. This is your book of shadows, your Facebook. I put out on Facebook over a year ago, I said something along the lines of, come on, universe, I need you to make things align and put me together where I get a chance to meet Bruce Springsteen. And almost one year to the exact same week, I met Bruce Springsteen.
Fantastic.
Isn't that crazy? And it's out there. It's not just Dave recounting the story. It's legitimately out there. You can go on my Facebook and scroll back through my pages and see a year prior me saying, okay, universe, make this work. And, you know, that's interesting because when we do set that intention, there is a magical property to that.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I was going to say, I buy it. I mean, that's a kind of a misnomer, but I accept that as something completely normal. I've had that so many times in my life that for me, it's like a more normal mind frame, a normal approach, a normal way of looking at life. And I'm very happy about that because that, I think one key in this magical process where you can open up to these things is to trust your own intuition. And for some reason, that's not something that we're encouraged to do in our culture. I don't know why. I don't believe any conspiracy theories in that sense, you know, but I think it's a good thing. And that, you know, when I lecture or when I teach in like art schools and things, that's the key message, you know, trust your own intuition, you know, follow that, you know, inner voice that you have and don't let other people put you down. That could sound like a cliched kind of thing, but it's so super, super important. And you wrote that thing on Facebook and you had that trust in, you know, the universe or whatever you want to call it. And it happened. I'm not surprised. For me, it's completely logical in a way. It's like what you call supra-causal. It's not just cause and effect. It's just like something has greased the machinery of the universe, and you did it.
Yeah, it's fascinating to look back. And when you talk to guests like you and look at the overall examination of the world around us, you can start to see these reflections. So even for the most hardened skeptic and cynic, if you start, kind of really looking back at the times you've set this intention, and some people will say, well, sure. Yeah, I wanted to be a doctor, so I buckled down and I worked hard and I became a doctor. That's one thing. That's working toward a goal. Mm-hmm. But if you've ever wanted to write and you just sit down with even the smallest nugget of an idea, like, and I've mentioned on the show, Stephanie Meyer, she had a dream about a sparkly vampire. That was it.
Yeah.
That nugget turned into a multi-billion-dollar industry with the Twilight series.
Exactly.
It's opening up and allowing the magic to come through you and not something you've worked towards, but something that the catalyst is out there. You just have to light the fire and see what comes of it.
Yeah, yeah. I do believe, though, that they go really well hand in hand. I mean, you have to also, causally work for what you believe in. I think that's, when I said that almost jokingly, greasing the machinery of the universe or destiny, I think, that's how you grease it. You have this faith in that, these strange things that I'm doing will lead to this. I really want this to happen. But then you also actively work with it. And that work process is, according to me, what greases up the machinery and makes it happen, because so many people are causal hard workers. They strive towards a goal and maybe they reach it, maybe they don't, because there's the things called competition. People might be more competitive, and so you just need to, when you're on a mission, you need to have all the tools with you. Some of those tools will be visible and they will be causal, there will be cause and effect, and some of them will be invisible. And I mean, for instance, I think that if you have the central thing, like your own will, your own will needs to be well defined. But that, the definition helps this outer causal material process of, creating change. But sometimes an undefined will on inner level also works really well. It could be like a yearning, Sometimes, for instance, let's take an example. If you're a way, you want to hook up with this beautiful woman, for instance, and you say to her, I would really like to hook up with you. And then that might be like the complete turnoff for her and she'll just disappear. However, if you have it in a verbally undefined way and instead show what you feel, show what you would like to see happen, it's a classic case. That's usually a much better avenue to walk if you want to achieve that kind of success. So there are different ways of expression, and parallel, well, almost if not parallel universes, then parallel modes of being. One is the mechanical causal work to make something happen, and the other is kind of a what I call a programmatic approach, where you program yourself and allow the seed that you drop into your subconscious that needs to work on its own. It doesn't need to be defined. It's like a little flower that helps this other outer process happen, and vice versa.
Have you heard much about the other side of this, when things do go dark, when this is used for ill intent, and what can you point to say this is, you know, this, there's proof of this, that this exists?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that I've never had any experience, you know, where this classical thing, like if you do a curse, it will, you know, go on a rebound, it'll hit you in the face, stuff like that. I've never experienced it that kind of dramatically. However, I have certainly come across some people who've done things. Oh, wait, let's stick with one of my favorite scenes from movie history. You assume that you've seen Fantasia.
Yes.
Yeah, so you know the scene where Mickey Mouse is the sorcerer's apprentice, right?
Right.
Right, so he finds the magic book, and he's lazy. He doesn't want to clean up the room of the sorcerer. So he makes, like I said, this kind of magical formula from the book, and whoa, there are these, you know, hundreds of brooms helping him to clean up, but it's just a mess. He can't control those forces, you know. So the sorcerer returns, and the temple is in disarray, and it's just a chaotic thing. And Mickey Mouse, you know, he gets taught a lesson. Don't use magic if you don't know what you're doing. And in that sense, I've come across people who've perhaps, like Mickey Mouse, taken on more than they could handle. So bad things have happened to them. But then again, this is speculation. Perhaps something bad would have happened to them anyway, because they were from the beginning unbalanced individuals. They should not have gone into these sort of experimental mind frames. In a way, it's like with psychedelic drugs. In a way, you know, there's this classic Timothy Leary thing where, you know, he said that set and setting was so important if you wanted to go on one of these psychedelic journeys, meaning that you can't just take one of these substances and you know, get on the subway or go on the highway, or you need to be in a calm context where you can go in peace and quiet and let this agent work on you for, so you can discover things about yourself. You just can't take it and sort of throw yourself out there in a very violent and fast and stressed world. That will backfire. And that, in a sense, is what I've experienced, that people who were already kind of unbalanced, they may have worked with things, and, you know, in a way, maybe you could say that, sure, they experienced a rebound. They tried to create something bad because that was their immediate whim. And that is always bad. Anything magical, any kind of real magical work or operation or ritual needs to be very clearly thought through. You know, use your ability and know who you are. You simply, you know, you can't do a ritual for winning the, what's it called in America, the
lottery. Right, lottery.
Yeah. It's like $400 million. I want it by this weekend, you know. That won't work because the odds are so slim. But in a situation where magic could work, it's like there's the chance of promotion at work. There are three contenders. You are the least likely one. You know it. But you do a ritual for at least trying to push this or grease this machinery, as I call it, and then you get the promotion. And you can't explain it because you've been the least likely contender, but at least you were employed at the same office as the other ones. You've done your fair share of good work, etc. Meaning, you are in your natural surrounding. You can't really go beyond that. And if you want to go beyond that and do something spectacular, then you first have to change yourself. You can't, you know, expect the impossible. However, you can slightly more expect the possible.
I've got, you know, time's getting away from us quickly. The show's going by here. But looking into the book and kind of going through, I want you to talk about some of the different aspects. If people are looking for magic in their lives and in the arts and the things that they surround themselves with, Carl, what can they start to watch for? What can they start to do to alter these things?
Well, I think that it's again, I keep I'm so stuck with this thing that there are two sides to everything.
Right.
I think one obvious side is that you can look for things thematically and be inspired by that. And by that, I mean, you know, there are all of these on the shallow level, on the level of entertainment, for instance. You know, this past decade or decades, we've swamped by, you know, magical stuff like Harry Potter's and Lords of the Ring and all these things. And it deals with it thematically, it deals with magic and fantasy and, you know, mystic stuff in an entertainment form. But if that affects you in an inspirational way, that's totally fine. You know, so, and that goes for literature too. There are many examples in music where, you know, for instance, classical music, Gustav Holst's The Planets. It's a beautiful suite of music made for each planet. I would say that's a highly magical piece of music because it really evokes those classical forces of the planets based on ancient ways of looking at the universe, you know, saying that Mars is a very, you know, masculine, feral force. You call it, you know, martial energy when it deals with military stuff. And Venus is, you know, symbolically something very feminine and loving and stuff like that. You know, so Holst wrote this suite of music. So it's both thematical, but it also affects you in a way that you can't really explain. It's just, you know, magical. Then, of course, there's magical is an adjective that doesn't necessarily need to be tied to the thematic. You know, when you read something or you experience something, it could be like a dinner with friends and you had such a good time that you said, hey, that's amazing. It was really magical. You know, you might have experienced something out of the ordinary, an atmosphere that was concocted by the people present that wouldn't have been there if only one person would have been gone. You know, so that kind of thing where you experience facets of human life that are slightly beyond the ordinary. And then that adjective comes in hand. You know, it's magical. And that's basically what it means too. Magical and magic, it's not just trying to cause change to happen so that you can, you know, satisfy your own ego saying, I want this or I want that. It could also be an experience of life that is simply beyond the normal, beyond the causal, beyond the conscious, beyond the rational. And those aspects I find are increasingly important. And for some cultures, they are just so ingrained that it's not magical. It's normal for them to appreciate life in that way. But the Western sphere, meaning, you know, Europe and North America, it's like we've taken the rational to such a degree of extreme application that it's actually it's not good. It's not good for the planet. It's not good for our lives on an individual level. And I think that, you know, kids understand. They understand the magic. They understand the magic of play. They understand that you can, with your imagination, make things happen. And I have no idea why adults in the adult, you know, becoming an adult, why we lose that. I would say it's a cultural thing. But I do believe that loss of the child's perspective is exactly one of the most detrimental things there are in our culture. And again, you know, as I said, playing is magical, you know, enacting these things that kids do with sticks and stones could be. You don't need the latest, you know, Star Wars toys to get into that groove.
Wait a minute. Can you hold on? Let me go get my kids so you can say that all over again for them.
Yeah.
They don't need the latest and greatest toys. They can get by with sticks and stones.
Yeah,
that sounds like a thing every parent needs their kids to know.
Yeah, yeah. They might be hard to convince, though, because kids today are tough. They're tough. So, but what I'm saying is that ability to imagine things I see that less and less, specifically also in adult people. And, you know, usually, as you can read about that in the book also, I'm usually prone to criticizing, you know, contemporary times in terms of allowing technology to take over. It took over very quickly after the internet, and we are all swamped and fragmented in, you know, memes and tweets and Facebook and all of these things that are essentially super great. You know, they're bringing us together, but at the same time, they're chopping up our perception to minimal little ingredients that I feel at times I don't really control. And again, it's not a conspiracy theory. I'm just saying that contemporary Western life is very fragmented. And again, you know, why is it then? I mean, it's not surprising then that things like meditation and, you know, massages, things that are corporeal, they have to do with the body and they have to do with relaxation. They are super important. And it's not surprising that, for instance, remember that way back in the 70s or even the 80s, yoga was looked upon something weird and Indian and you know, something esoteric, something having to do with the Beatles and drugs even. But today, yoga is like everywhere. There's a yoga studio on every block. You know, so that's amazing how things that are beneficial, they will creep into the culture when there's a need for them. And it has nothing to do with entrepreneurial spirit or someone seeing a chance or an opportunity. I think it goes beyond that. I think it has to do with human need, with cultural, societal needs that manifest themselves when we're at the heating point. And I think that's why themes of magic return also in popular culture. I think that's the reason for its, strong presence, is that we have this need for a mythological approach. We can no longer, for any longer period of time, be fragmented, chopped up in these small little meme things. We need larger perspectives, bigger pictures, mythological approaches.
Right, which has been a part of our culture all along, hence
of course
religion, right? People follow religions because they want to feel that they are a part of a bigger thing and that they are part of a machine that, you know, they've got that they can rely on other people, mm-hmm. to rely on their beliefs, to rely on all of that. So, you know, in every religion, there's magic, there's sorcery, there's powers and abilities going. And that's everyone, folks. Don't kid yourself. Even in Christianity, it's heavy with that, right? I mean, Jesus is walking around creating miracles. Is that miracles or is it sorcery in a form of magic? His intention and power, focus and determination so strong and said that, you know, hey, what I can do, you can do. And it's then giving you the inspiration. It's just who takes that inspiration, who wants to utilize that and go forth. Now, what are the ties, do you believe, or any, to the occult in the afterworld?
No, I think I've consciously left that area out in a way. I've certainly been interested. I mean, you know, of course, most human beings are interested in what happens after death. It's something that you can't really, you know, just discard and believe that you have discarded it. I don't buy that. However, I came to the conclusion or afterthought, after thinking about it when I was younger, and saying that there's really no point in my sort of allotting time and energy and hypothetical energy to thinking about these things, because it's a question with currently without answer. When I die, I will find out. And I feel pretty content now with the wait, because I'm enjoying my life. And I think that there's no rush. I would love to stay in life a bit longer. And I would certainly hope that there is some kind of, you know, at least recurring thing that we can come back somehow. And I mean, is it, you know, just a fabrication that many, many of the major religions have this point of view? I'm thinking specifically of the Eastern religions like Hinduism and Buddhism and stuff like that, that we come back, you know, we take a seat in a new body and we try again. And I'm not saying that, you know, Buddhism is like something, chiseled in marble forever, that they're right, you know, with the karmic thing and the reincarnation. But it is a fascinating thought, though, and one that surely brings a lot of hope to a lot of destitute people. And that, unfortunately, is where the negative aspects of religion come in, you know, where religious structures and, you know, larger entities have taken control of people in dire straits and say that you have to do this to get this afterlife thing. You have to do this and fulfill these things that we tell you because they are morally correct. You know, I strongly disapprove of that. However, I've met many genuine Christian people who have been fine human beings because they have taken, you know, the message of Christ and the Bible and however they interpret that. And they've done something with it. They've integrated the teaching in their own lives. And I think that's commendable. And that's true for all religions. There are bad structures, but there are also good people who roll with the philosophy of things and try to integrate that. And I just wish more people would do that, actually.
What do you, when you're putting together a book like this, what is the end result for you? What are you hoping that listeners or readers, I should say, in this case, get from this book? And we've just barely skirted the main issues and principles of this book, but, you know, as a tease for listeners to pick it up and educate themselves, what do you really want them to get from this?
Well, for me, I think that's, you know, it's basically an anthology of lectures and essays that I've written and thought about a lot over from the past years, like the past two, three years. So it's recent stuff, and thereby my thinking is fairly homogeneous. It's, you know, there are red threads. Some lectures deal with these things, but yet you can find a red thread that goes to another lecture or essay that's also included in the book. So it is kind of homogeneous, and that surprised me in a way, in a positive way, when I worked on it and then had it as, you know, as a manuscript, when I say, wow, this is really a book. This is not just a collection of things. It's a book containing my thinking about these things. And basically, you could say there are two strands in the material. One strand is historical. It deals with esoteric history, with esoteric people in history, concrete things, historical things. And then the other strand is more speculative, and that you could say is more like, in a way, magical writing. It talks about magical concepts, how people have integrated magical concepts. There's also, as an extension of that, a lot of talk about magic and art and magic, how these two things have been so intertwined since, this classical thing, the dawn of time, whatever that means. But very early on in human history, the reason for making art was strictly magical. There was no need for, you know, self-expression or that kind of more neurotic approach that artists today have. It's a communal thing. Art was made to make something desired happen, and also to make the undesired things not happen. So it was a tool. It was an existential tool. And I hope that's coming back. So I'm writing a bit about that, sort of contemporary examples and historical examples of where this thing has shown its head again, meaning the desire to unite these things, to make art magical again, and also to make magic more artistic. Because the magical community has also been, for a long time, very, very conservative, almost reactionary, in the sense that they've had their blinders on. You know, this stuff works. We'll continue doing this thing. We're Puritans. You know, even though other people on the outside would say that these are, you know, just experimental freaks. But at the same time, there's so much going on now in another field, which is, of course, the natural sciences, physics, you know, biology, chemistry, astronomy, things that are completely mind-blowing. And of course, the scientists dealing with this now would, in the medieval times, have been killed straight away. No doubt about that. But so I would say that the classical magical stuff is actually literally arcane. You know, maybe it is no longer meaningful or relevant. I would say that the only relevance that a magical approach has is through art, because that at least brings it back to the human primordial need to express something, to make something beneficial happen in either the individual life or the life of the tribe or the society or something like that. So science, I think, will be very, very, very important for the development of these esoteric theories, and also personal artistic expression. Those are the two main strands.
people can tap into the magic around them. And it's not just some woo-woo metaphysical nonsense, right? I mean, we can access, whether you want to call it universe, you want to call it God, you want to call it artistic creativity, there is a magic that surrounds us. But do you also have a faith or a belief in the type of magic that we read about, you know, in the Harry Potter series or the Witches of Eastwick, or, you know, is there something to the legends that surround that type of power?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not wholly convinced, though, I have to say. I've experienced some weird stuff, like in Asia, for instance, where I've seen things that are, I probably wouldn't have believed them if I had seen them in the West. But again, is that mainly because I came to this exotic location with high hopes of seeing things? Did I delude myself? Did I sort of trick myself into seeing these things? I think not, but it could be at least a part of a piece of the puzzle. In the Western sphere, I think one of the reasons why I prefer often to use like a psychological language or a psychological grid or matrix when I'm looking at these things is that it feels more relevant to me. To have a Harry Potter approach and say that, you know, you take your wand and you zap that thing with a magical formula, that's very arcane. And I'm not saying that it doesn't work. Maybe it works. But I wouldn't ascribe any external forces to it. I would ascribe it to the internal forces of the person doing this ritual with this symbolic wand. I think the human psyche has more of a potential to reach out in non-rational ways than science has yet, you know, acknowledged.
And in so that the tools sense, like a magic wand or incantations or, or, you know, brews, what you think is maybe those are crutches. Those are crutch tools. That they're giving more, they're lending more credence to that than they are to the idea that the power is actually coming from within.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where I am now. I mean, when I was younger, I believed that, you know, there were more like, you know, external forces, but never like, you know, demons and angels and these sort of arcane, they're all symbols. But, you know, the most fascinating thing in terms of tuning into magic, that's of course to be in nature. You know, nature is a very magical place because it's kind of, I was going to say unpolluted. Unfortunately, that's not true. It is kind of polluted by humans and human soil. But if you just, you know, go into the forest or watch the ocean and you're just amazed at the power that's there. And, you know, some people who have a religious inclination, they would say that, well, that's God for you. Other people who have a more scientific inclination, they would just say that this is like a supreme intelligence and it's the evolution of the species. And it's just all these different grids and matrices that we feel the need of seeing the world through and seeing our lives through. I believe that, you know, you can tune into nature and that will give you a lesson about the forces that are there. However, if I use these forces or think that I'm using these forces for my own purposes, is that then externalizing something that is essentially in my own psyche? I don't know. I'm more of an internalist now than I used to be. I believe in the power of the human psyche and, you know, whether that's strict mentalism or manipulation, or whether it's an actual transference of energy via the mind, it's kind of secondary because what people are usually after is result. They want to see a tangible change, and I do too. I would avow, you know, I would sort of integrate something that I know works. I'm a pragmatist. Pragmatic magician, and I would sort of stay away from stuff that people say, you know, I don't know, it's interesting from an historical point of view, but why should one dress up in these fancy robes and use these, you know, arcane tools, when in fact one of the most powerful tools we have is the computer and the iPad and, you know, and the internet and even more, you know, modern stuff and quantum physics. You know, could there be something more magically mind-blowing than quantum physics? I don't know. I don't think so.
Fantastic insights. The book will be out in March officially. Again, we have a link up so you can go pre-order it right now. A Culture, the Unseen Forces that Drive Culture Forward. Carl Abramson, our guest today. Carl, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you. It was great. You had some great questions there, and I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to learn and get some education for me and for our listeners. And hey, guys, if you want to be a part of magic, join me in Romania this September. We're going to Transylvania. We're going to follow in the footsteps of Vlad the Impaler, Dracula's course. We're going to follow to where he was born, to where he was last laid to peace, to imprisonment castles, his castle, and more. It's going to be a fantastic time this September 2018. You can get information by visiting darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com. We're already half sold out on this trip. You can sign up right now. Don't miss it. This will be the adventure of a lifetime. And if you can't find it for some reason, email me and I'll send you the direct link. Email me dave@darknessradio.com. That's dave@darknessradio.com. We'll be back again tomorrow with another brand new edition of the best in paranormal talk radio, plus theater of the mind, right here on Beyond the Darkness.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply.
May is Maytag Month, and Menards is passing the savings on to you. You need reliable and energy-efficient appliances to conquer the day. Menards is your one-stop shop with appliances in stock and ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Save big money on Maytag appliances at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save.